I'm Chris Lydon. I wrote to Dave Wine, it seems like yesterday, 2 months ago, but I said, Dave, yesterday I didn't know how to spell blog, tomorrow I want to be one, and here we are. I have a new address as of yesterday, it's called blogradio.org, and it's just a pleasure to be here. This session is the sort of theory and practice, except it's all theory, no practice. At Harvard, it's not enough that blogs work in practice, we have to figure out does it work in theory? and what is the theory? To me, the question in this session is essentially the word transformation. And I'm going to begin by asking each of the panelists to sort of give us a number on a scale of 1 to 10. What kind, you know, how big a transformation are we talking about? Very eminent panel, flown at great expense from Amsterdam. Adam Curry, of a hugely complicated and illustrious career starting at MTV, and now in blogs and a lot of technology. My colleague Jim Moore, who writes his own blog and who sort of adaptive reuse of the second superpower idea gave it a huge extension on the web. The incomparable Dr. Azin Searles, who teaches us all how to write on the web. And Elizabeth Spires, who has a new address as of a couple of days ago, it's now The Kicker. She's now The Kicker on New York Magazine. She used to be The Gawker. And she's going to, among other things, explain this word snarky and why she was called the snark queen of Manhattan. But I'd like to begin with Doc, if you will. Doc, you're Mr. Clue Train. You're in the locomotive of the Clue Train.
I'm one quarter of Clue Train.
Well, yeah. I think of you as the guy with the locomotive chief hat on. Where's the Clue Train? Where are we going? Where is it stopping? Who's listening? But give us a number first on transformation. How big is this thing?
Transforming what exactly?
Reality. Communication, human experience, the possibilities, anything you
before
want.
Clue Train, I had this. I collected my archives in something called Reality 2.0. Because I was convinced that a transformation was coming along anyway. And that goes back to like 1985. I mean, I thought the PC was a huge transformation. And look at the room. All these people have PCs, right? And the net transformed everything. And we're all on the net, right? All the PCs kind of get shut down as soon as the net shuts down. Right? That didn't used to be the case. I think that both those things and a pile of protocols and APIs and formats and other things which are coming out of the weblog developers community. RSS data just came along in the last couple days, which I was talking to Jeremy about. All of these have the capacity to vastly transform the way we do things. I think radio and television are going to be completely changed by syndication, a concept that's an old newspaper concept, for that matter. I think the answer is 100%, actually. I mean, so I'm an extreme optimist about that.
Adam, color it in a little bit. Give us a number and give us an idea of what's being transformed and how.
Well, I view weblogs maybe a little bit differently than a lot of people here, what I've heard in the panels. For me, it's just a tool, and I see it as just as revolutionary as the telephone. And we're probably using it in ways similar to the way the telephone was used when it was first invented, namely to call ahead to tell you that a telegram was on its way. So we're probably still figuring out how we're going to use this tool. I agree with Doc that for broadcast, such as radio and television, yeah, transformation will be 100%. Not quite sure how or when, but you can feel it happening already. If just seeing, well, for instance, your interviews, which I think are great, and hopefully everyone has at least heard one or two of them, but the way those are now distributed through RSS, and I don't think we should get into what that is or how it works, but all I know is that in the morning, I pick up my iPod and it has the new Chris Lydon interview on it, and doesn't matter how it got there, but to me I call it reverse TiVo. You know, I didn't have to tell anything to go record. It was pre-recorded, and I just had it when I wanted it, which is the same net result.
Go back to, this would be a sort of take-home question. Compared to what, in terms of technological transformation? I mean, is it it's bigger than the fax machine? Is it as big as the railroad? Is it as big as movable type? Is it as big as, you know, the spoken word? Is it the discovery of language? And I'm also interested in the kind of political social transformation in terms of, you know, an international transformation, a power transformation, thinking transformation.
Well, perhaps this is just the start of us really connecting all brain waves. You know, we might figure out how that works, and I'm totally convinced that there is a connection that you can transmit and receive brain waves from individuals and sometimes over great distances, and maybe this is a start of that, you know, because we're kind of all acting as human routers, content routers, literally, where, you know, within 5 minutes of me posting on my weblog sitting right over there that I was out of power, Doc picked it up, passed his adapter over to me, and, you know, so there's something there that is much bigger than the physical layer, I believe. So maybe this is it's a precursor to that.
Elizabeth Spires, give us a number and tell us how it's changing your world, which is the most sort of inside, sometimes nastiest, sometimes most desirable and wonderful world of kind of Manhattan media, finance, who's who, celebrity.
I think for me, you know, it's kind of hard to say because I have such a very granular perspective on all of this because in one capacity I'm a media commentator on my blog and that's part of what I got hired to do for New York Magazine. So I basically get paid to sit around and navel gaze and, you know, whereas a lot of people in the media, sort of, we all do it for free anyway. But it's been, or the weblog phenomenon has been particularly unique for me because I'm generally a pessimist, and I picked up blogging as a hobby, and I remember whenever I started it, I picked up blogging in 2000 for about a week, and then I stopped, which I think most people do anyway, and then I picked it up again in 2001, and it stuck for whatever reason, and I remember, you know, the medium was very unique then, and people would talk about blogs as an entree into journalism, and I would scoff and go, "Oh no, that'll never happen." And then it fell on me when we started doing Gawker because a lot of media people started reading Gawker, and I was suddenly getting phone calls from editors. So it's been very different, but it's made the world so much smaller if you're in that industry. I put something on my personal blog a few days ago about having lost a galley of a book that I was reading, and it was edited by the political editor of The New Yorker, and I never update my personal blog anymore. I do it like once a week. I figure no one reads it. And then I get an email the next day from an editor at Simon & Schuster that says, "Jeff Frank, the guy that wrote the book, emailed me and wants to know if he can get you another galley." You know, so that's summarized. If you're in the media industry, you know, it really has been kind of transformative because people are sitting around thinking about these issues, and you see big media trying to co-opt the advantages of the medium in a million different ways, and that's what New York Magazine kind of did by hiring me. And from a larger perspective, I think it's really just kind of a sophisticated nuance and or continuation of how the internet generally has transformed things. I don't think it's this.
I saw you quoted somewhere saying that just a few years, having a blog will be like having email. That it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be such a fixture. Because it has made the media industry a lot more, I think, meritocratic. Because when somebody gets a job from blogging, like me or anyone that I know who has a blog and has been contacted by editors to do pieces or publishers, you know, there was I can't remember, Julie Powell, I think, did this project, this Cooking with Julia Child thing that she was doing where she was doing all of Julia Child's recipes and blogging them on the web, and she got a huge book deal a couple of weeks ago, and that was, you know, it wasn't something she was looking for, but every time that happens, it kind of, I think, encourages people to gravitate toward the medium, and it makes editors a lot more open-minded about looking for writers there.
So. Jim Moore, tell us about the second superpower. I mean, talk about transformation.
Okay, well, people who know Chris and me know that Chris kind of goads me on. So I want to scale this up and say this transformation is huge. And it's not blogging per se, but it is blogging is the current moment of this incredible coming together of consciousness across human beings. And I think if you take this idea that each person is going to have a blog like they have email, well, right now, Yahoo and Microsoft Hotmail, much of their traffic, I think it's actually more than half, comes from the third world. And it's a huge issue for them. And if you go to Africa, what you find is that everyone's got Hotmail or Microsoft accounts, Yahoo accounts. This is a very big deal. And so now if you imagine 6.3 billion people in the world, and maybe 300 million are kind of connected now, but it's moving fast, right? You go to Ghana and you see 100, 200 internet cafes and lots of users all the time. And you imagine all those people blogging. That's a big deal collectively. I mean, that's really a revolution. One of the things I think about a lot in Africa is how there's a real interest on the part of political elites to not let the digital divide be sort of bridged out in the impoverished areas. Because think about the population of South Africa that still is very much not connected. Think about all of them blogging. That's a very complicated thing in that society, especially for the ANC, actually. So I think it's a huge deal in politics. I think that nations, so second point, nations are not working well. I mean, we look at these super problems we've got, global warming, racism, you name it, okay, war. And then you look at the nation state and then the clubs of nations, the UN and so forth, and they don't work, right? So somehow we need some way to aggregate wisdom from kind of each of us into some bigger systems. And we don't have that in the nation state. And so the reason I wrote The Second Superpower was that there was this idea kind of floating around that the public opinion was the second superpower, countering the first superpower of the Bush administration. And I didn't invent that idea, but what I did do was say, well, gee, okay, that, slightly a fantasy, but if we wanted to make that a reality, what would we have to do? And I think the answer is just a lot of work we got to do. And some of it's happening in this room, some of it's happening in political rooms, some of it's in the New Age area where people are thinking about consciousness. So that's the...
So you're a 10.
I'm a like, yeah, whatever number you want to
call. I've drunk so much of the Dave Weiner Kool-Aid, I get dizzy now. I want to kick it beyond 10. And for me, there was a funny coincidence between starting a blog and Ralph Waldo Emerson's 200th birthday. And I've always been interested in Emerson. I started, but suddenly struck me that blogging is a fulfillment of the classic American writer, Emerson. And it is his world of, first of all, expressive individualism, that whole Emersonian notion of trust thyself, every heart beats to that iron string, express your view, express your contradictions, get it out. The worst thing he says in Self-Reliance in the first page is, you don't want to hear your idea coming back from somebody else tomorrow. Name it, claim it, get it out there, add to it, Emerson was a big universalist. He believed in a universal spirit. He believed we were all connected democratically to it. I mean, for which the internet is a perfect sort of electronic metaphor. He was I don't want to say multiculturalist, but he was a great reader of Indian philosophy and he was a personal friend of Wordsworth and Carlyle, all these people. He was a great traveler. He was a great performer. He was a blogger. He was a blogger before his time. And it connects with something Dave Weiner said in another context. He said, blogging is an unbelievably American thing. And you see it, you hear it, you feel it in Emerson. So I go totally off the charts in terms of the possibilities of transformation, including the international side of it, too. So I'd love to... Let's see how high we can go with a number here. Who wants to say 15, 17?
I wasn't thinking of a number to go up. I was thinking of a number to go back because I thought the first blogs were by Benjamin Franklin with Poor Richard's Almanac.
Let's talk about President Thomas Paine, I.F. Stone.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Junius in England.
I mean, blogs are connected forms of and a well-respected form of journal that's been around. Here's a way of pushing it in the other direction as well. Is like, how big is this thing? I really think what we're doing is dismantling and recreating the matrix here. I think that in the industrial age, especially with media, and I think the matrix, by the way, is a metaphor for the media. That's what it is. We have received experience. Here's an interesting thing. I'd like to hear what Glenn and hi, Glenn. and Jeff have to say about this. Because last night I was following links from their blogs, and read all kinds of stuff about Gray Davis being abusive to his staff. And I thought, well, I'll tune in the news and see if it's on TV. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't on TV at all. They were still busy bashing on Arnold, right? And I realized, well, that's what the Matrix wants me to listen to right now. And so I turned it off, and I went back to the blogs. Because there was a lot more in the blogs. The consciousness of what's going on out there, even if not everybody's agreeing about it, people are vetting these ideas. People are bringing up stuff that nobody's talking about anywhere else, least of all in the Orthodox media.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think we're much too modest about what we've discovered here in blog world. Going from blog world to, forgive me, public radio, or even the New York Times, is stepping down at levels of consciousness, expression, intelligence, critical thinking. I think it's sort of shocking, and I think we ought to be a lot bolder about saying we've found something. We've found a kind of candor. We've found a kind of, you know, shit detector, authenticity detector, relevance detector that's going to change the world. Anyway,
I think
you can explain how. How do we implement it? I mean, I worry about, well, and I've asked you a number of times, where's the power of the superpower, the second superpower?
Well, they
certainly lost the first round on the Iraq War.
Yeah, and I think that's what has you. That's what causes me to say that we need to think about what we can do collectively to have power. But I think, first of all, I think one of the things. First of all, I think it's not good to focus only on this as an individual phenomenon. It is that, and certainly those of us, as we've started to blog, understand the personal transformation you go through. But it's really a collective phenomena. And so a lot of the interesting action is in all the meta-analysis and the sort of meta-relationships that can be structured and can be explored. But what we need to think about is how to make ourselves a kind of a collectively wise community. You know, Howard Weingold talks about smart mobs, but we need wise mobs. And I think that we... certainly there was a kind of a wise mob that was sort of in the face of the Bush administration as in the build-up to the Iraq War. It interestingly kind of fell apart as the war got going, but I think now is coming back in full steam. I mean, one of the interesting things is that
What's the evidence?
Well, the collective wisdom of that mob was correct, right? I mean, we were right. You know, this isn't working, okay? I mean, the fundamental, and people forget this now, interesting, people forget that the analysis wasn't mainly that, you know, we couldn't win this war or whatever, things like that. It was that this war as a means to deal with Saddam Hussein in the Middle East wouldn't lead to kind of an effective, lasting peace there. And a lot of the analysis was that you can't really blow up a society and then have democracy spring out of it. It's a lot easier to blow something up than it is to do the kind of hard ecological work of forging a democratic society. So I think what a lot of people said was, if we go in there, it'll be worse. I said this. I'd been in Jordan a few months before. A lot of neat stuff was happening in Jordan that's not happening there now. We've made it much worse for democracy in that area, not better, by sort of ripping it apart and traumatizing people. So the kind of the collective wisdom of the second superpower was correct, and now we're seeing that. And so I think a lot of it is understanding our wisdom, accepting our role, and beginning to think about things like Joe Ito's emergent democracy, things like that. So
you know what reminds me of, Jim?
Yeah.
When I read The Second Superpower, I'm a little bit young to have seen the movie for the first time. I think it's still on Turner in black and white. Network. Mm-hmm. Run to the window and shout it. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And that was an actual network of people yelling from window to window, and it was more or less fictional. But that's exactly the same collective drive that I feel that you're talking about there.
I disagree. Actually, I think that was the only choice that one had in 1974 was to go to the window and yell in vast impotence at the walls, because nothing happened. And that was the point of the movie. The Matrix was intact.
But is that where it started, perhaps?
That's where it started. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt the crack appeared at that point, perhaps. But I differ a bit with Jim on the collective wisdom. I think there's collective interest, but I think that there are plenty of voices, Glenn's and Jeff's among them, but I single them out only because they're most familiar to me. I'm sure there are other people in the room who feel that the war effort was to some extent a right thing that is not necessarily working out the right way right now, but in the long run may have been the right thing and are withholding judgment on that. And I'm basically a pacifist, and I'm kind of in that in that position. I don't know where this thing is going to go yet. And I don't. And what I want to see are more bloggers in Baghdad. You know, yeah. We had Salam Pax and we have Baghdad Burning, which is true. And they're great. And but there, we need many more than that. We need more Sergeant, what's his name? The guy, the Chief Wiggles. Okay, more people like that, like Kevin Seitz.
What about more bloggers among the troops? I mean, wouldn't that
yeah,
be
those too, but that's Chief Wiggles is one of those.
Yeah.
But the collective wisdom has a lot of differing opinion, but if you mm-hmm. connect it and if you're treating each other with respect, which is one of David's favorite words, I think it's an important one, is that we do continue to respect each other. One of the things that you get on Yale TV and on Yale Radio, which is people at, you know, artificially assigned to polls that yell at each other. Paul Krugman was interviewed by you in that thing that was here a couple of weeks ago, and I listened to that, and then I watched him for like a half an hour on TV in the hotel, and he was not really allowed to say anything because he had a role to play, and the role just, you know, was too constricting. It was too, I mean, it was actually absurd, but that didn't come across because it was part of the TV system that he had to be the guy on the left who was fighting the guy on the right. You know, it's not that cut and dry. There is a rolling wisdom that goes on that has lots of contradictions in it all the time. The important thing is that it's connected and that more of us participate in it.
I guess I would like to jump in on that because I actually do agree with that. And I think that the...
come to the mic.
I think we need a system that allows for a kind of deeper and deeper pragmatism and deeper truth finding. And that we don't have that in mass media, but we may have it in this kind of rolling... you know, kind of rolling collectivity that we're a part of, and I also respect the diversity in the rolling collectivity, but I think if at any given moment you kind of assess the wisdom of that collectivity, what I like is that first of all I think it is telling us that this war is kind of off, but I also think that it's more reliable kind of meter for me now, and seems to be more reliable over time than the national political scene, with the exception, by the way, the Dean campaign we have to somehow get in here. Because it's a very interesting place where this kind of swarm has landed and they've embraced it, and that's also a big deal.
Yeah, please let's take a question in the back and open it up as wide as you like.
Hi, I'm Peter Weiner, and I'd like to say I'm very enthusiastic about this, and I think that weblogs are very powerful. I need to ask a disruptive question here.
Runs in the family.
Do the panelists really believe that Americans are going to turn off their televisions and start watching weblogs, start reading weblogs?
I think they're going to change their televisions. I don't think the television goes away. I think what goes on the television changes. Oh, probably less than that. But it's a valuable 5%. Or 2% or 1%.
I might make sure it's the only 5%. But having said that, I think that your average American is watching more television every year.
I think it's going down. Does anybody know? No. Yes, no.
Yeah, it's gone down 1 hour in the last year.
1 hour in the last year.
1999, it was 1 hour a day. It's gone down to 3.2 in the latest study from 2001.
That's a bit short. Yeah.
But is that time moved to weblogs? Is that also apparent?
Michael.
There's a Chris. Jeffrey Cole does a survey of internet usage.
Chris, you're going to turn the mic on.
Anyway, Jeffrey Cole at UCLA, he decided that.
No, speak into the mic, please.
We can't hear you. We need the mic.
Stand and speak to the mic.
He decided that he'd been surveying television. He thought, wouldn't it be neat if we watched time usage before TV and after TV? So when the internet came along, he's been doing a survey for, I think this is the third year, watching time uses, time budgets. And the interesting thing is broadband is one of the biggest things that changes everything. And I think broadband users, which are still a small point, they drop like 9 hours a week in television watching.
I think something else might be happening here. I think that people are tired of the dishonesty of television, and that is not necessarily what people are saying, but every cut, every zoom, every scene change is dishonest. And we're starting to realize more and more that, you know, that's just not the way real life works. Yeah, maybe you fill in the bits in your brain where you go from the inside to, poop, now we're driving in the car. But I think that perhaps the internet and weblogs have really made us much more aware that there is real life, and that's why you see reality shows becoming very interesting. We like stuff, but all the stuff that goes wrong is always funny. You know, that's why you have blooper shows, and America's Funniest Home Videos has been a success for 15 years. The dishonesty of how television is made specifically, and if you have a chance, read the Zen TV experiment. I have a link to it on my weblog. It's a must read. I think that we're catching on to that, and we're coming out of our hypnotic state of just being hypnotized by television.
Yeah, among other things, you can blog and have your television on at the same time. And most of the people I know, you know, who watch television at all, you know, are grazing, and they're there for the highlights, but they know when to tune out. And it's a what is, my cousin used to say about playing bridge, you know, it gives you something to think about while you're talking. Well, blogging gives you blogging gives you something to think about while you're while the TV is on.
Continuing in this disruptive vein, first, it's not how many people are reading blogs, obviously, it's how many are writing them, and how does that change their experience. But I've got the same problem with this sort of self-congratulatory feeling here. And, yeah, you know, maybe there is all this collective wisdom, but if you went to Washington 20 years ago, people would tell you how intelligent and plugged in all the people were on the Washington circuit. What happens both to reality and to our perception of people's wisdom when blogging genuinely gets democratic and it's not being done just by the elite in this room, but by people who are much more concerned with the PTA in their town, or by fan clubs, by people in Iraq who do not necessarily welcome freedom, what have you?
I just got to take exception there. I mean, to me, that's a sort of typical kind of blogger self-hatred. Is it really better? Hang on. I'm warned against hyping it, but wait a sec. When I was in college, the doctrine was two men in Washington defined the mood of the place, Walter Lippmann and James Reston, and that was it. It's absurd, and the idea that thousands of people giving their collective things and sorting it out on the web is not an advance for freedom and democracy. I mean, we shouldn't second guess that. That's progress. It really is progress. No, and we're all going to die someday too. I mean, please.
One of the things that's been clear in this is that this stuff is really messy so far, and in a way that I think is good.
Messy. Meaning, that messy
it's,
meaning.
It's messy in that it's really hard to pin anything down anymore, and you have to really go to a lot of different places to find anything resembling a truth, whatever that is, at this point. And I'm wondering if any of you thinks that we're going to find a way to, or should we find a way to make it less messy? And should people be out there grazing around all the time on blogs? I think people graze on blogs more than they do on TV.
The question is how to make it somewhat less anarchic and more thematic without losing the openness, I guess. Elizabeth, it's your turn. You solve this problem.
I guess, you know, one of the big problems right now is, and for me, because I was doing a sort of meta blog with Gawker where I had to read tons of stuff every day, and there were probably a handful of blogs that I could reliably go to get information. And so the problem beyond that was just filtering, you know, and developing better tools to find exactly what you're looking for, because, you know, as the blogosphere increases, you have that problem too. There's just too much stuff out there. How do you find what's good? I mean, to some extent, you can rely on specific people whose writing you trust, whose ability you trust, but there has to be a way to kind of identify new sources and just separate. I mean, I think it's, to a large extent, just a technical problem.
V?
Please, Michael.
So you're struggling with something which in the real world always sorts itself out. Interestingly, for this conference, we set up a metablog which allowed you to simply look at everything chronologically, which was fascinating, time-consuming, but not necessarily very helpful. I said to myself, I can't do that, or I'm going to be doing it full-time. If we could sort that by topic so you could only look at the stuff you were interested in, that might be useful. The real solution is that in the real world, you only look at the stuff you trust and find useful over time. And that's true whether you're interested in fashion or theater or politics or whatever it is you care about. It takes a little while, but you find out what's useful to you. You pick the magazines you buy and read. You pick the people you listen to on TV or whatever. We're going to do that in blogging, too. It's not as hard as you think it is.
Okay. That's the subjective blogger. But I think there's also the objective blogger. I mean, I think it's tremendous fun to go to Technorati, which is not necessarily at all about what I'm interested in, but see Technorati's rundown about what people are reading, talking about, wanting to talk about, et cetera. In the back.
Andrew. I wanted to get back to Esther's point about how it's not about the readers, but about the writers.
Speak up.
I wanted to get back to Esther's point about how it's not about the readers, but also about the writers, and, you know, putting a number on that. One thing, you know, I run into is, you know, even talking to very geeky people and, you know, tech-minded people, there's, you know, still kind of there's a set of people for whom you say, like, oh, well, there's a thing called, you know, blogging, you explain what it is, and the response is, you know, why would anyone do that? And I know at some point they'll get it. I know it's, you know, at some point there's a good chance they'll get it, and they'll see why it's important, why there's value. But I've yet to identify what the, you know, what the spark is, how you push people over the edge. And, you know, certainly wanted to know, you know, if those on the panel had any experience kind of finding, you know, because we've all had the experience of evangelism and, you know, getting people into it. And I still don't know exactly what it is that, you know, that would push, that would make it, you know, more interesting for more people.
One really interesting thing we had happen with Gawker was that, you know, probably 8 out of 10 of the people that read the site had no idea it was a blog and don't know what a blog is. And that was the big, you know, back door in getting big media to kind of co-opt what we were doing, was that they didn't look at it as this hot little web phenomenon that's for geeks. You know, they liked the content on the site, and they knew that we were getting traffic and buzz, and they wanted to be able to capture that. So, I mean, part of it is that you portray it in a way that's maybe less alienating to people who aren't technical users. You focus it around the content, and that's, you know, standard old media.
Yeah. Please.
Emerson had a day and a horse trip before he could actually begin a conversation, where now we can spread lies and mistakes on our weblogs faster than ever before. I'm wondering, is this collective wisdom a safe thing given the experience of the last century? Is the second superpower going to be someone we can trust?
A good question. Glenn Reynolds and I talked about this in an interview. Do you want to respond to that, Glenn, on this matter of the lie getting halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on? And do we fact-check your ass? I mean, is this a cleansing process, or is it just another way of, you know, starting a flash mob, a mob of misinformation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's some.
The mic is not on.
Oh.
On the bottom.
I have to yell.
I'm under a technological curse today. Mm-hmm. I think it's some of both. Of course, a lie was famously able to get halfway around the world pretty quickly when that statement was coined. Now I think the truth catches up a lot better. And you see the ability to correct things quite rapidly. I mean, newspaper corrections lag necessarily by at least a day, and usually days to weeks. Bloggers tend to correct stuff as fast as they can, as soon as they discover the error. If you look on my blog today, even though I've barely been able to get online, I managed to note that one story that I'd linked now looks like it's not true. I put an update and said that. I mean, blogs make it a lot easier to do that, and I think it's what Mickey Kouse calls the asymptotic approach to the truth, and it's sort of the opposite end of the infamous LA Times theory about, you know, do it once, do it long, do it right. which usually seems to translate into let somebody else do it. You know, it's really a chance to put an idea out there, get a response, and filter repetitively filter through these responses and feedback that you get until you arrive at something that's more like a consensus view of reality, which, of course, could still be wrong, but at least it's a consensus that's wrong instead of an idiosyncratic wrongness.
Please,
was that at all helpful? No.
Yeah, it was very helpful.
Yeah.
Could I just throw out a question, and then we'll more questions coming back. But I keep thinking of it as the sort of the Larry Lessig question. Larry knows everything about the web, but he's the most deeply pessimistic person in the world, and he thinks we've been had by commercialism and by the architecture and the whole thing. And I keep wondering, the last time I heard his kind of elegy for the internet was before I caught on to the blogging thing. I'm wondering, is there something here to make Larry an optimist? I just let that one sit and cook. But in other words, is blogging the true promise of what the internet was supposed to be 10 years ago? Not the investment possibility, but the social, democratic, cultural transformation. Question.
I'm David Weinberger, and I think one of the things that blogging, that the web in general and blogging in particular has done is driven the last nail into the coffin of the myth of objectivity, which for a generation we've known isn't really possible, since it means seeing the world when nobody's looking at it, you know, as if there's no human involved. So we've known this for a long time, but now with blogs, because they're linked, we actually have the ability to, we have multiple subjectivity. It's not simply subjectivity. It's not even intersubjectivity. It's these multiple subjectivities that we can get multiple viewpoints on any one issue, which is where I'd suggest that the common wisdom resides. It's a property of the net itself. Truth is a property of the net itself at this point.
I'd like to respond, if I could.
Jim Moore, please.
Yeah.
Close to the mic.
I think the real issue here is not that this... the issue is that we finally have in front of us the problematique of how we can collectively become wise. And so if you read Thomas Friedman, he sees the web as a kind of a dark net where hate can thrive, or a lot of the time he does, and sort of the, and that's true, that's happening. Okay? On the other hand, there's also very wise things happening. There's a lot of dialogue going on, a lot of working through facts and doing analysis. But what we have, I think, for the first time now is a kind of a critical mass of connected people and connected minds, and we can begin to think about how we work together to make this be wiser and wiser. And that, to me, is like, you know, that's like Athens or something. You know, that's like the invention of democracy. But we have to do it.
Dave Weiner.
I try to answer my brother's question. It doesn't matter so much that everybody's doing it to me, okay? What matters to me is that I'm able to communicate with people that I want to be able to communicate with. And if you look at the topology of how communication used to work versus how it works now, dramatically changed. It used to be you'd have to flow your ideas through a very narrow funnel, get it accepted by them, make sure that it comes out in the same sort of making the same kind of sense that it made when you thought it up. Yeah, it was impossible. You couldn't communicate to the rest of the world on that basis. Now I can, and it doesn't mean that everybody that I could possibly want to talk to is going to read it, but at least some of them can. And that's a major difference. It doesn't matter whether everybody does it. What matters is if, as I think you said, the right people are doing it, and the right people are different for every one of us. So, yeah, it is a mass market thing. There are, to answer Esther's question, there are people doing it in homes and PTAs and stuff like that, and I'm never going to hear about their blogs, and I'm never going to read them, but they don't particularly care if I read them or know about them, but they care about the people who are reading them, caring about them. And think decentralization. You know, it's the competition isn't TV. There really isn't any competition. The idea is communicating between without being centralized. So, different way of looking at it.
Please.
Well, I have to disagree with that. And this is back to some of the disruptive questions. May I? Lowered a drop there. Mm-hmm. I'm Liz Reba. Last year I took a course in social informatics, computers and society, and we looked back at the introduction of previous information technologies and everything, you know, TVs was going to revolutionize education. We put TVs in every classroom, distance learning. Radios originally, again, broadcast education to rural schools. Everybody could be a small broadcaster in the early days and broadcast regional stuff. Again, even print started out with the highest goals. It was the Gutenberg Bible. Now we've got Weekly World News. We've got talk radio. We've got, you know, all kinds of garbage on the network. The media isn't the message. The media can do great things. The media can do lousy things. You know, blogging will accomplish good things and bad things, but I don't think we can say blogging in and of itself will revolutionize things more than TV has revolutionized things, more than radio has revolutionized things. I don't think we can...
Okay,
I'd like to disagree with that.
Point is taken.
I'd like to disagree with that because...
So would I.
The airwaves for... I'll make it short then, Chris. The airwaves for radio and television are regulated. Was it not regulated then? Didn't take long for it to get... I don't think it'll be regulated. No. Can someone give Esther a microphone? That would really help. I'd like to hear what Esther has to say.
It's simply, I wish, I'm very optimistic. That's why I do all the stuff I do. But I'm also old and wise enough not to think anything's going to change human nature. And I think it's great that we're doing this. I think there's a huge difference between being active and being passive. But we should also be realistic here about precisely history when, you know, the American Revolution was amazing in its time, and it had genuine impact, but did it change human nature? No. It created the world we live in now.
That's an important point.
Okay.
But let's just remember, there may be 1, 2, 3 million bloggers out of 6 billion. This is in its seed. I mean, this is... We've barely seen it. I'd like to throw out the question to the panel and to all of us. How does it need to be shaped, regulated, protected, guided to come to a sort of full flower as a universal medium? Doc?
Universal literacy. I actually take the libertarian position here. I don't want it to be regulated. I don't want it to be...
What about protected from all those things that ruined the Internet for Larry Lessig?
I think it's self-protecting. I agree with Larry Lessig's where his paranoia comes from, because it's well-earned. At the same time, I think the tide is turning in Congress. I think that the DMCA never could be passed today. I think it's likely to be rescinded, at least in part, in time, as more and more... elected officials get connected, and as more citizens get connected to elected officials, I think what's really going to change it is the mundanities of communication that have nothing to do with blogging. I was talking to Phil Winley, who was the former CIO of the state of Utah, a couple months ago, and he was talking about, you know, emerging democracy is less interesting to him than emerging governance. And emerging governance is when any citizen can get in touch with the city and tell them that the water main is broken and has real communication with elected officials and with appointed officials, and all of that process is far more connected than it is now, and that's going to happen. It's just going to take some time, and I don't think it will change human nature. I think it's going to equip parts of human nature that are not fully equipped yet. That's sort of my optimistic position.
Michael.
My name's Ted Henderson. I was sitting here thinking of one point, which is this notion of transformation. I don't know whether blogs will transform the media. I don't know whether blogs will transform the political scene. But there's a very simple thing that they do, which is they create connections, to Dave's point. Elizabeth, you said maybe someday blogs will be as common as email. Whether that's true or not, the vast majority of the blogs that are created will be diaries, gibberish, but they won't be gibberish to like minds. And they won't be gibberish when someone in Zimbabwe discovers someone in Afghanistan, if they ever get wires to get it in there. They won't be gibberish across international borders. And you talked about the telephone, when the telephone arrived. Well, the thing about the telephone is, short of teenagers, I don't know too many people who just pick up and dial a random number to see who gets on the other line. But with a blog, you can do that. And you can discover people. And all the rest of it is terrific if it happens, but just the notion of connection itself is amazingly transformative.
Thank you. Thank you. Please, Jeff.
Here's an idea for transformation. It's the death of the gateway. We were the gatekeepers, right? Now, in my business, in journalism, I got to be the gatekeeper for a short time in my career where we were the gatekeeper to information or the gatekeeper to power or the gatekeeper to the audience. And what this really does, or what's more important in the last 20 years, the gatekeeper to celebrity. But all that comes down here with weblogs now, where, you know, I've got Jason Calacanis, who's trying to start a weblog company, on IMDb because he's watching this on the broadcast, and he's very happy, he's laughing at home now to hear me say that. The point is, this is now broadcast to the world to those who want, who are like minds, who want to watch it. The gateway is, the gatekeeper is gone. The death of the gatekeeper, I think, is a very important and very transformative and revolutionary thing. It may not change life every day, but it's going to change institutions in big ways. It's changing journalism, it's going to change media, it's going to change government, because the people will have more power. This is a populist revolution because the people now have tools. The internet is the first medium owned by the audience, and the audience isn't the audience anymore. They're the people in charge. End of spiel.
Well said.
But they're not controlling it.
Okay, hold it. This.
And what? When have you been prescriptive from having anything on your table? And I have a conflict of interest here. My company owns it. Want to be served.
Get the mic.
If you want to do a server at home, and port 25 is blocked.
Blog it here. Jeff, take the mic.
No, it's not on here.
Let's move. Michael, you've got a customer back there.
This is in response to Esther and second what Ted said.
It is. Speak up or into the microphone. We can.
This is, I am.
Yell.
Okay.
Close to the mic.
I'll speak as if the mic isn't here. This is in response to Esther and to second what Ted said. I think one of the reasons, I'll just speak for myself, the reason why I am so excited about weblogging only tangentially has to do with the destruction of institutions I don't care for. On a personal level, it's because it feels like it's exactly congruent with human nature, which has, I'm going to guess, just has something to do with putting yourself forward in a shared world and connecting with other people. That feels to me like human nature, and weblogging lets me do this better than I was able to do before. So it's affecting me pretty deeply.
Andrew, please, in the back.
My name is Henry Copeland. I think Jeff's right on in talking about the death of the gatekeeper. Something I think might alarm a lot of the people in this room is that a lot of Americans think the gatekeeper is liberal, and a lot of weblogs are conservative. So I think it may be naive to be utopian and say, finally the great liberal agenda will be achieved. I think, you know, things may head in the opposite direction from what people here would like to see. Just a reminder.
As far as transformative, how many people are using or have used NAFS or download? Somewhere like 50 million people, and they're probably young, and they don't vote. How many people signed up for the don't call list, and what was the fastest law ever passed? So what happens when 50 million users decide to vote?
Interesting question. I think the whole matter of human nature opens up another big, big field. In a few of my interviews, I've asked bloggers, you know, would you want to introduce Blog World to your mother? Would you want to take these people home? And I ask it really because I'm struck that, blogs are so full of human nature, including nastiness and a lot of blog envy and what I call the sort of the high sticking impulse. But also a lot of lazy impulses there in blogging. The linking rather than writing. I'm with the people who say there should be more writing and less linking. But do we want to talk about human nature? Do we want to talk about left-right in the blogosphere? Do we want to talk about sort of good and evil? I mean, how much human sort of violence is and hatred is being unleashed in this medium too.
Like a lot of people here, I'm, I would say I'm an optimist, I guess. I do think it's transformative. I'm excited about weblogs, but like Esther and other people have said, the human nature part of it argues, in my mind, against the utopian views expressed up here in this way. One of the powers I think most people in the room would agree that network communications has in general is the power to find like-minded people, as was mentioned over here. And human nature, that is a corollary of seeking facts that tend to support your view. And that's what a lot of people do out there with blogging. And that argues against the very notion of having true dialogue on all these issues with the truth ultimately emerging. So I'm optimistic, but I'm not that optimistic.
Okay. Andrew.
Steve Garfield. I think the concern about the wire and whether that's going to restrict things is valid, because I don't remember the service provider, but I think there was one that was restricting people linking to live journal sites. Or people remember that? Yep. AOL. What was the do you know the details? But yeah, they.
Can I try to address this human nature? Let's accept for granted that it doesn't change human nature. Okay.
Closer to the mic, Dave.
Oh, let's just take it for granted, accept it, that it won't change human nature. It'd be crazy to think that anything like a technology could do that. But what if it brings out a human nature that was previously not allowed to come out? Or what if it's one that's been suppressed due to centralization of communication? We used to have campfires, we used to sing songs, we used to tell stories. We used to have smaller collections of people communicating. Well, was the monoculture, at the dawn of television, could you have asked, this won't change human nature? Well, actually, it kind of did change human nature. Back on it. It got us to be very centralized. It meant that in order to perform for other people, you had to be perfect. Only the perfect people got to perform. So maybe it won't change human nature, but maybe it will bring out parts of human nature that we haven't been exercising. That we haven't been using. I mean, I don't think any of us are smart enough to know. So why bother debating it? I mean, let's just play with it as long as it feels good, as long as it does no harm. The woman over there who said, what if something terrible happens? Well, I think you should save that for when something terrible happens. There are so many things you can worry about, but, why? the whole point of this panel, by the way, was to share some optimism. and I might add, about human nature, nobody gets flamed more than I do. And if I can stay optimistic, you can.
Michael.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yeah, please.
Human nature is hardwired, and nothing but evolution is going to change it. But I think we're definitely due for a software upgrade. And it's clear there are so many cases of human transformation, enlightenment, people in very short periods of time completely changing the way they think, that I don't think we should shut the door on the possibility that this technology can be a key to raising consciousness on something of a massive scale. We don't know where it's going or how much it can do, but I think the promise is there, and it's enough that we should keep going in the directions, all of the directions that we're going on that.
Thank you, Michael. Another just general question. What needs to be done to make this truly an international, a global phenomenon? Everybody knows the Baghdad blogger and Baghdad.
What do you mean it's not international,
Bernie?
Chris?
Sorry?
What do you mean? It's not international?
To make it more so is all I mean. I mean, I want to hear from Eastern Europe. I want to hear from Africa. I want to hear from Russia.
Well, regular Europe.
Absolutely.
old Europe?
Old Europe.
No, but seriously, I've heard everything I've heard here today has been about American politics, the situation in America, about the war in Iraq. That is not what weblogs are all about, and that is not what the social democratization that we're talking about. It goes much further than that. Weblogs in Europe are not discussing Iraq. They're not discussing American politics. They're discussing very other issues.
Like what?
Local issues. Did you know, for instance, that we're building the United States of Europe in Brussels, and that all countries in the European Union basically have no more say over their local politics, that it's all these decisions are being made by non-elected officials in Brussels? And these are big issues that will affect the United States when it turns out that the United States of Europe is 400 million people with one single currency versus 350 million with one single currency. So it goes a lot further. I don't know why that got an applause. But in this conference particularly, I've noticed that it's been a lot about what the U.S. media is reporting and how that is being debunked or is imploding upon itself. But it goes much, much further than that.
But to me, the question is how to deprovincialize American conversation. And this should be a tool for it.
And I think it is. But it just seems that here we've been discussing a lot about journalism and media and big media, and do we need, somehow it feels like we're very close. We've cordoned ourselves off in this room during the discussion today.
Let's open it up. Michael in the back.
To change the conversation a little bit, I've been studying, and I'm sure I know other people in the room have, some of the discoveries by Professors Barabasi at Notre Dame and Duncan Watts at Columbia on the characteristics of self-organized networks, of which the web is an ideal example, in which the blogosphere is perhaps a culminatory example. Some of the commentators are saying the increased linking of blogs. One of the things that students of the science of networks indicate is that it's vulnerable to cascading failures. All of us in the Northeast certainly had an experience with that just 6 weeks ago. Although it's very robust, very able to survive random failures of individual nodes, if there's a failure of a particular hub or a concentration or a central point, and that could be because of the failure of it or because of the perversion of it, such as the sort of thing that happened in Europe in the late 1930s with the rise of Nazism, and which we've seen in Eastern Europe, in Yugoslavia and Serbia, where a meme catches hold and spreads rapidly through there, a isolated network. Once the network is globally connected, can a meme like that spread globally too fast, too furious?
Interesting question. Jim, that's your second superpower he's talking about.
Well, our global, it's a sort of a global mind. I mean, I think, we are starting to experience phenomena like this. I mean, neuronal recruitment is kind of the current kind of neurology way to think about how the mind works. And what happens on the web is this kind of neuronal recruitment, or recruitment of people to a meme, and we are opening up vaster and vaster spaces for that. I think it's really interesting what will happen with that.
But do you want to guess? Do you want to worry about it or not?
Yeah, no, I'm worried about it all the time. But I think my best shot at it is to kind of keep writing hopefully reasonably positive memes into it and stay experimenting with it. I mean, we're at a really early stage, right? I think we've got a whole new playground here, and we don't know what we're doing. And, what I think is fun about the Berkman Center is we're invited to experiment and then also try to reflect on it, as are other people in this room. And so, to me, it's just a fascinating time that there's a kind of a new space opened up here with incredible amount of interesting stuff happening, and, we're trying to play with it.
Kevin Marks. 2 points. One is that the net contains lots and lots of people, more people than you could ever possibly read, more thoughts than you could ever possibly grasp. So what you see of the net is what you look for. The net is Caliban's mirror. You see a reflection of yourself in there because you go seek out things and find them there. And if you start looking for dark things, you'll find dark things. If you start looking for light things, you'll find those. So trying to make generalizations about it's full of bad stuff, it's full of good stuff, is not really helpful. It's full of people. Following on from the second point about the self-organizing systems, what you see when you have a self-organizing system is what's known as a power law distribution. This is a sort of fairly well-known thing now. It applies to the size of cities, the size of earthquakes. It applies to income distributions. Most obvious example is things like popularity of records and movies, where you see that there is the most popular thing is enormously popular. The second one is maybe half as popular, the third one is a third as popular, and it goes on down like that. Now, if you look at those power law curves, if you look at them on the net, they go all the way down. I plotted out the data from Technorati of incoming links to blogs. I got all the data off Dave, that's helpful. And it goes all the way down, almost all the way to one incoming link. You have this power law relationship that goes down. I plotted out the similar data for newspapers, for movies, and for had some music data. And they start out with the power law, and they suddenly do that. They taper off because there is a barrier to entry. It is very hard to get a record into the record shops. You have to persuade someone that you will sell 100,000 records beforehand. It is really hard to get a movie into the movie theaters. You have to persuade someone that you will sell several million dollars worth of seats. So what you see is this comes down like this, then it drops like a stone. The promise of the net and the promise that blogging provides that wasn't there for these other media, and this addresses Esther's point, I believe, is that we can fill in that big missing triangle. And what happens is when you have all those little people down there with incoming links who don't show up on the radar when you start counting top tens, taken together do outweigh the top ten. And the intuitions from classic media are wrong. What happens with classic media is you get into a battle for those top ten positions. You get into a really nasty zero-sum conflict where you have to put all your resources into trying to get to be number one because number two is only half as good. And the actual return goes down enormously. Whereas with the net, with the rise of the net, you can get enormous returns much further down that curve because you can't get enormous returns, but you can get returns. You don't have that barrier to entry to get.
I think you passed the Dave Weiner test of optimism.
Excellent.
If that, Bill Greenspan.
I wasn't going to talk, but you wanted somebody from the back, so I'll give you some pessimism. I hope nobody from Google. I hear they've been shutting anybody down who talks about AdWords, but I happen to know somebody who uses Google AdWords, and you get paid 50 cents per 1,000 impressions. So my weblog, which is graciously hosted on the Harvard Law School server, I think it's the second most popular blog on the server, something like 450,000 page views in the last 6 months. So if you work the numbers out, I could take $200 from Google and put it in the bank for the last 6 months of effort. So there's the pessimism there, because I think I'm on the, I hope, I guess, well, now I know that I'm on the kind of the tail of that media curve with my $200 in revenue. So there's the pessimism. You can't really, it becomes totally non-commercial, I guess, is my point.
So I'm John Udell, and I have a completely different view on the commercial angle here. I think it's largely irrelevant to most people to think about this in terms of media and performance. And I think it's extremely relevant in what I see as the emerging free agent economy to think about this as just a routine, professional way of projecting yourself and your expertise out into an environment where it will be found. In fact, it cannot not be found by someone who's interested in looking for it. And to the point about the power law and the small clusters, that's exactly it. Someone who has expertise in a particular subspecialty of open source software is by definition of interest to a very small number of people. But demonstration of knowledge and expertise over time in a weblog is the modern equivalent of a resume, but it's far more powerful because whoever is looking for that expertise will find you. And so, you know, the connectivity that happens in the free agent economy, I think, is the real engine of commerce here, not anything which is going to take readers away from the New York Times.
Yeah. Panel, do you?
Oh, yeah. I've heard a lot of people kind of skirt around the money issue, and I totally agree with Dave, not that he said that today, but he's written it before, that you probably will never make any money or no more than $200 in half a year by writing on your weblog. Personally, I've probably made $2-3 million with my weblog, but none of it had to do with my writing. It was promoting myself, lying about the competition, whatever the hell I had to do. And it's worked.
More cause for optimism.
And human nature.
I'd like to suggest that very many of us in this room, contrary to what Esther suggested, we're not elites for blogging. And a lot of people, I think, are kind of surprised to be recognized by each other. I'd also like to suggest that, this is utopia. All right? I think where our great-grandparents were living and what they were able to do. The reason this seems like it's not utopia is because what we can now imagine is so amazing. And it sucks by reference. And my last point, fortunately, is that blogging happened once before. It happened in the Enlightenment. A combination of coffee waking up Europe from a centuries-long sleep, alcohol-induced sleep, the only other safe drink. Okay, and you know, I think Dave Weiner is Samuel Johnson. Okay, and the rise of the essay and the cheap printing press in Europe was in fact the blog of the time. And the
you don't think he's Isaac Newton?
He can be both. It's his conference. So suddenly people could write essays, and we had that explosion. That did create the revolution, and we're doing it again. So human nature is incredibly fungible thanks to the meme, which is now in many ways replacing the gene. Global Brain by Howard Bloom has a lot on this.
Over the top. Thank you. That's terrific. Michael.
Here's the reason why I'm optimistic. I have a quote on my right side of my weblog from Wayman Williams, English sociologist, who says, in fact, there are no masses. There are only ways of seeing people as masses. And I think that describes very well the monocultures thing. It developed a really good way of seeing people as masses so that you could aggregate them and throw advertising at them and charge them and so forth. And that had a long run. That's a couple of hundred years development in the skill of seeing people as masses. And the only thing that makes me completely optimistic is I just think it's over for that way of seeing, which is what I think Adam was trying to say when he said that cuts lie, editing lies. It's that discourse that comes out of a particular way of seeing the people on the receiving end of what you're doing just doesn't have that much momentum anymore. And seeing people as conversationalists, as fellow human beings once in a while, people who can talk back, that simple fact is very, very powerful.
Beautifully said, but can I just say, Jay, that's pure Emerson. I mean, he said the problem is masses, where he spoke of everything he did in his life, he said, was about the infinitude of the private man, was about the individual consciousness, about individual, you know, self-reliance, the whole thing. We're getting back to some deeply, profoundly American ideas.
And as you know, I'm optimistic about it. Please.
Something that happened about 20 years ago in music is happening now in writing, which was MIDI in music. It was a format that basically, and technological tools that let people create extraordinary music in home studios that before that took unbelievably powerful big studios to accomplish. And it's this going out to the edge in all kinds of areas. Weblogs are only the most recent example of this, and I think we need to put it in that context. It's why I'm optimistic. It's the edge is now getting its say against the middle, against the center, and that's the best thing of all.
Dan, thank you. Please.
I'd like to go back to the original question of whether weblogs will transform or do transform anything. I think if we go back to listen to the conversation over, people have moved in and out of whether specific tools transform. And I think what we need to look at is that it's not the tool that's doing the transformation. It's what the tool is affording us to be able to do that we couldn't do prior to that. And that tool may die, but that thing we could do goes on into a different tool, which now adds another piece. So we look back at the telephone and then the TV and the telecourses and all these distance education things we did, and they all disappeared as educational tools across distance, but what they allowed us to do moved into a different tool, and that what we need to do is figure out what in weblogs we are creating something we couldn't do before and then make sure we hang on to that.
Is it in danger, do you think?
Well, I think that any tool is in danger if it gets... all right, let me back up for just a second. I think that when we glorify a tool and then the tool dies, then the things that are in that tool tend to die with it because people associate them all together. And I can't come up with a great example right now, but I think that if we look at it historically and say, you know, there are a lot of people out there, if I go back to my field in education, there are a lot of parents who think technology isn't going to cure anything and it's a waste of school budget money, which is very tight right now. Because we've been saying for eons that schools will be transformed by technology. And this has now been 20 years, and parents are still waiting for the transformation, especially those who are in troubled schools. And they're saying technology hasn't done it, so let's look elsewhere. And I think that we put our money into hardwiring and saying the hardwire will cause your schools to change, but we forgot to train the teachers. And now we're training the teachers, but now we're missing some other things. So I think that it's not maybe that weblogs are in danger right now, but if we say it's the weblog itself, the tool of what we're using to do this on the web that is creating the affordances, and not what it's doing, the cooperative grouping, the getting people together to have a common thread, to aggregate information, those are the things that it's allowing us.
Well said.
I'd like to speak to that, if I may.
Please.
You said a bunch of different things there, but the one about schools strikes me in a way, because I think while we've been busy trying to equip the supply side with yet more ways to do things with technology, what really happened was that the demand side got equipped. So, and what's really happening here with weblogs is that the demand side of journalism has been equipped to supply enormously and has changed the field entirely. It's happening with education. Students now have ways of educating themselves that far exceed what there was before, and the institution is coping with that, and more technology on the supply side really isn't helping. I think an insight that I just got as you were speaking about weblogs that I didn't have before, it came from you, is that I can't see masses when I'm weblogging. You know, I mean, Glenn has 100,000 readers. I'm sure he doesn't see a mass when he's looking at them. You know, you're writing for one person. You're writing for yourself or something. And I realize also that, you know, what I saw on TV last night was yet another example of this machine seeing me as part of a mass, and I'm not that, and so screw it, and I turn it off. You know, and I go back to the. It's not even a medium; it's an environment, really, on the net where there's a cacophony of voices that, to some degree, I can parse and get some sense out of, and that sense is a lot more coherent and useful to me than anything that's coming down the pipe from the instrument, from the organization that's still busy thinking it's talking to masses. And it gets more absurd by the day. It's a wonderful thing.
So for more than 25 years, I ran around the landscape making speeches in front of thousands of people and only actually being able to communicate communicate with some very small number of them in a way where I actually knew anything about what they really wanted to say to me as opposed to what I wanted to say to them. And then I put up a weblog, and hundreds of people wrote me about what they wanted to say to me, which is at once a humbling and very exciting experience. And I think that that says it all, because it's not just what's happening to people like me, it's what's happening to everybody from PTA moms and teenagers who have weblogs to doctors who are communicating with each other and finding out for the first time that maybe their patients would like to tell them something, to everybody else who's participating. It's a new method of communication, and it has a new kind of payback.
Thank you. Very well said.
Hi, I'm Bruce Weinberg. I'm a marketing professor, and I have a boring, pragmatic question about blogs. And I've gone through this experience, and I agree. It's a wonderful form of self-expression, a lot of quality and excitement in the content. The notion of perhaps a utopia out there, and is it thrilling, exciting? Absolutely. Can it make a connection? Certainly, I agree with that. The one ingredient that I've seen on what's happened with at least a lot of commerce or sites in general is the notion of someone facilitating the connection. So when I go to eBay, if I want to find something, if I can't find it there, I'm probably not going to find it anywhere. The great thing about Google, if I want to find information, I happen to be in Japan, I think it was 97 or 98, and I was going to get a camera while I was there, typed in cameras, and Bill Greenspun's site came up. Now I can say thank you for that, got a good camera. And I think also some of the things happening with Meetup, that all these people want to get together, and really that's a mechanism to assist and facilitate the connection. So I'm curious with blogging, I've been looking for some kind of search tool, something to help me find people with like topics, and I haven't been able to see that. I've seen some things at MIT that are people are working on it. I went to Blogger, and I didn't see anything there, so I'm really, other than trial and error or following links here or there, really to assist the what's out there?
I think the answer is standing right next to you.
Well, we're going to have a session on this tomorrow, Infrastructure 130, pound 204.
Last thought? Last profound thought. Behind you, Andrew.
To come back to a kind of a pragmatic level, Philip made an interesting point arguing that blogging may fail as a economically, I would say that if blogging is going to fail economically, all content creation is going to fail. Bloggers are the low-cost producers of information. Google may have failed to give Philip more than 50 cents a CPM. I would think there'd be a lot of advertisers out there that would think, gee, I'd really love to piggyback Philip Greenspun's reputation. You've got a guy like Josh Marshall doing 1 million page views a month. You've got the New Republic doing 2 million page views a month. They charge $40,000 for an island ad, and Josh can afford to charge a lot less than that. So, you know, that's an aspect you guys didn't touch on, is the economic ramifications for the provision and the creation of content. The whole information architecture is premised on charging folks money.
Oh, but I also believe that Chris's interviews could be sponsored just like public radio, like NPR. You could become a subscriber even though you get it for free. That would just depend on how you know, why do people give to NPR?
But the beauty of it is that it's not. There are huge volumes of acreage web pages, many of which my company has produced, that are sponsored and when you seek sponsorship for something, it changes it. It doesn't make it bad necessarily, but it changes it. And to me, part of the beauty of weblogs and part of the energy that's in this room and that makes all of this exciting is that there is no economic basis for it. There is no economic justification for it. It is created out of love and out of a desire to communicate. That is a great thing in itself. It doesn't have to succeed economically to me for it to succeed.
I think you summed it up very well, Scott. There is a kind of soul and a heartbeat in this medium, and that in itself is the promise of transformation. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
We got to go quickly here. We have 15 minutes for a break. I want you all back here at 4 o'clock for Weblogs and Presidential Politics. Starts crisply at 4 o'clock. Thanks.
Yes, I think. Were you on this morning?
Yeah, I read the panel.